We are in the British Library in the Sound Archive. I'm here with Cheryl Tipp. And can you tell me what your job title is?
My job title is Curator of Wildlife and Environmental Sounds.
Okay. So what's in your part of the collection?
Well, in my part of the collection, the majority of it would be species recordings. So we have a range of recordings. We cover birds, mammals, amphibians. We have fish recordings. We have all the animal groups we can cover. But we also have atmospheric recordings as well, so rainforests or woodland or, you know, the Arctic tundra, all of these different kinds of environments where the species live. There's about 220,000 recordings that are catalogued.
Can you tell me a bit about the history of the type of recordings you're talking about?
Well, in terms of wildlife recordings, the very first wildlife recording was made in 1889 on a Edison phonograph. So it's carved into a cylinder. And that was made in Germany by a young boy, about 8 years old, called Ludwig Koch. And he became one of the finest pioneers of wildlife sound recording in the 20th century. And it was just his birthday present that his father had bought him, this phonograph, that sort of pushed him onto the path of becoming this amazing sound recordist. So he was practicing recording wildlife in the early 20th century. He left Germany in 1935 and came to the UK because of his Jewish background, and started to record British wildlife. And it was the first time anyone had ever done that. And he borrowed the EMI recording van. In those times, they had to carve the recording into a wax disc and then take that back to the studio and press it and then listen back to it to see whether the recording had worked. So in this recording van, they had a little oven where you would have to heat the wax to a particular temperature. If the wax was too soft, you wouldn't get a good enough signal. And if the wax was too hard, the stylus wouldn't go in. So it's incredibly difficult when you think about it today, how easy it is. You can just whip out your phone if you want. And then it just gradually grew. Certainly in the 50s, where recorders, like analogue tape, turned up and it became a bit easier. I mean, they were still massive machines, but it was easier than taking a disc-cutting machine with you around the country.
I'm interested in those parallel histories of photography and sound recording, and it strikes me that they sort of run alongside one another. Were these early pioneers connected to photography, or was the early wildlife sound recording connected to wildlife photography?
As far as I know, no. I think they were quite separate, even though there are parallels, and both are trying to do a similar thing in a way. They don't seem to overlap. I don't think there were many conversations going on between the two groups, as far as I know. But you can see similarities, for sure.
There's something curious about the idea of the sort of natural recording. It sort of takes a leap of the imagination to say, it's not enough to photograph the robin, you know, in a studio. I have to go and photograph it on its nest. Mm. And is there a similar thing with sound recording?
Yeah, well, in the early 20th century, around 1910, when people started to get more interested in recording animals, it was too difficult to go out into the field to do it, so they would do it in a studio or in an aviary or something like that. So the very first commercially released disc of birdsong was of a captive nightingale. But they were quite sterile in a way. I mean, it's a miracle that they were able to do it in the first place. You know, they had this nightingale, they had an Edison phonograph, they put the cage by the recording horn, the bird sang, and there's even a story of them making a little perch inside the recording horn and putting the bird inside the horn so that you get a bit of that signal. But again, that's only good for so long, you know, because ideally you want to hear the animals vocalising in their natural habitat. Otherwise the background is just not correct. So that's why I think people knew they could record birdsong or wildlife in kind of a fixed position, you know, in a studio. But then they wanted to take it to the next step and say, well, that's all well and good, but I want to hear what it sounds like in the natural world. I want to recreate the sounds of the natural world. A lot of it's timed to certain seasons as well. If you want to create an identification guide, say of mammals, you can't just bring in a fox and make it, you know, create those particular sounds that they make during the breeding season. So to get a true representation of the sounds of species, you have to go out into the field to do it.
But that almost describes a sort of documentary ethos.
Exactly, and they still do it today. I mean, field recorders that I know, they will turn up, they'll be in camouflage, they will have a hide, they will cover it in some kind of army net, you know, so that the animals don't know you're there. It is a very documentary approach, and there are similarities between film as well, you know, that kind of aspect of documentary.
So in the, we're just going through the history you've mapped out there. So the first time people can do something without the help of a like a broadcaster is probably in the 50s, did you say?
Yeah. So sort of from the 50s, certainly once you get into the 1960s, there's more and more people recording just for fun, you know. And so in 1968, the Wildlife Sound Recording Society was formed. So that's a UK-based international group that encouraged people to go out and record wildlife. It was a nice little community for everyone. They could talk about different tape stock and they could talk about different techniques. And there were people there that were making their own microphones, making their own parabolic reflectors. It comes down to kit. It comes down to equipment and the versatility of the equipment and the ease of transport. And really people in this field who would then write about it, you know, and set up societies and encourage others to do it.
And who would listen to the recordings?
Well, for the Wildlife Sound Recording Society, the members shared a lot of the recordings between themselves. They were circulating tapes and everything. Again, some of them went into publishing. You know, they wanted to share their recordings with others. Now we can just put it online and it's a lot easier. But then they would get LPs pressed, and then they would get cassettes pressed. And it would be a mixture of, there's an identification guide, and then there's some nice soundscapes, or we're recreating the sounds of the African bush.
Are there things you don't know what they are?
Yes, there's a lot. Even the recorders may not know what they're recording, you know. And so a lot come in and it says, like, mystery animal. It may not even be an animal, you know, it may not be. Or mystery bird, and it turns out to be a frog.
So we're going down now into the basement.
Yep, we're on our way.
This the first, how many basements are there?
There's four.
No.
They go down as far as some of the tube lines, so you can hear, like, the northern line rattling pearls.
So we're going through a... It's like... I have to say, it looks a bit like a prison. There's a series of gates. And then long corridors with these fire doors going through them. So as if by magic, all of these gigantic shelves move sideways.
So this is how it all started. When we would get material and recordings in, we would put them onto species reels. So we've got about 8,000 of these, and then so there's about 50,000 recordings.
So this is quarter-inch tape, is it?
This is quarter-inch tape, yeah.
So each one is, you've got a sort of square white box with something written on the spine? What's that? Scientific name of the species. Yeah. So what is that box you're opening now?
That's a good question. I should have picked one I knew. I can tell you. It is a Rufus hornero. I don't even know what that is. I have to look it up.
But it's only a tiny bit of tape there.
There's, yep, there's only one recording, like? And it's 25 seconds.
That's amazing.
Yeah, whereas other ones are completely full. So by looking at this, it suggests to me that that species is quite rare or very localised. Then you've got other ones that are more, the species is more common. But here, like a chaffinch, so we've got, what's that, 11 reels of song, and then 6 reels of calls.
Do the recordings come with pictures?
Not often. I think for wildlife sound recorders, they have to make a choice. What do you do? Do you take a photograph or do you record the sound? Because if you're recording, say you want to record this bird and it's vocalising, you have to focus on that, you know, maybe you have to turn your mic a little bit and you have to check your levels and maybe you've got your recording and you're like, that's good, stop that. And then, you know, by the time you get your camera out and then try and take a picture, it could have flown off. Or some recorders I found started with sound recording and then they've moved across to photography and they've left the sound recording behind. And some have started with photography and moved into sound recording. So people do switch between the two, but they don't generally do both at the same time. There has to be a kind of choice, and they need to focus their energies and the finances that they've got and their interests, either one or the other. I find.
I mean, would you prefer, when you're listening to the recording, to see a picture, or just prefer to be immersed in this recording?
I think I would prefer just to be immersed in the recording. If it's purely just for interest, and I don't need to try and identify it, or I just want to listen to it, I just want to listen to the sound. I don't want to be distracted by anything else. Maybe afterwards, once I've listened to it, and I, for example, when I first heard a superb lyrebird, this Australian bird, it's such a beautiful song, incredible song, and I wanted to see what it looked like afterwards. And there's actually a lot of these birds have very beautiful songs, they're not so striking to look at, you know, they're normally a little bit plain. I mean, it's got a cute tail that comes over its head, but you know, it's not amazing. But for me, I think I would be more, if someone presented me with, I've got this picture of a bird and I've got a sound recording of a bird, what do you want to go to? I would go to the sound recording every time. That's just because that's my interest, that's how I work.
Is there a thing in birds that if it's a dowdy bird it sounds better, and vice versa?
Can be, yeah. So some of the most beautiful birds, you know, they're incredibly stunning and they've got these lovely colours and everything, like hornbills, or, you know, they look magnificent, but the sound they make is quite boring, you know, it's quite, there's not much going on. Whereas if you think of like a nightingale, little brown bird, it's alright, but its song is fantastic. Or reed warbler, or the little brown birds, you know, that just all look the same, but their songs are incredible, you know. So it seems to be like a little trade-off. Either you're good looking but don't sound very good, or you've got an amazing voice and a little bit plain. So it's,
yeah,
there's this trade-off happening.
So that it's a bit like the sort of photography sound recording thing is happening in the species themselves.
Yeah, in a way. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
How many actual photographs do you have with the recordings? Is it a very rare thing to happen together?
It's a rare thing, yeah. It is a rare thing. I guess we haven't really encouraged it. If we did encourage it and we had a better way of bringing the two together, I think it would happen more and more. Certainly for birders or people that lead bird tours, who are also making recordings, and they're probably documenting it with photographs as well. But we don't tend to get very many. It's something we'd like to do, and also move an image, you know, to bring everything together.
There are sort of strange formats like paper recordings and...
Yeah, yeah.
How many... So sort of before quarter-inch tape, what is there?
Before quarter-inch tape was lacquer discs and shellac discs, so hard flat discs. And then before that, it was a cylinder. And then before that, it was, say, paper with... like soot, you know, put over the top of it, and you get the pattern traced in it, but there's no way of playing it back. We can play it back now because you scan it. We worked with a university and they scanned the groove made in the paper, and then we're able to convert that into sound. We can't actually play it back, sort of in traditional. Like, you can play a cylinder or you can play a disc, but with the early material. But that was so early, it doesn't tend to survive. They found this one. I can't even remember where they found it. It wasn't in the library. But you don't often come across them. Just because people would look at it and say, well, I don't know what that is. You know, because it's not like a photo. If you look at a photograph, even if it's old, you think, oh, I know that's a photo. Whereas here, everyone thinks of sound as being recorded onto a disc or a reel or a CD. So if you've got a piece of paper with just a little line, most people are like, I don't know what that is. Get rid of it. There's just so much. There's just so much stuff.
You don't succumb to the Sisyphean task of trying to, you know, complete this.
No, because it can't be. I mean, how long has the collection been going? Since 1969, and no, we're still not up to date. It was impossible because you've got more material coming in, you know, all the time, and then you've got all of this to process. It's not like a finished collection, you know. It keeps on changing.
Do you have a sense of whether more is coming in? Being catalogued, or
I think more is coming in than is being catalogued, because you've got a mixture of people clearing out their lofts, you know, or their collections, and sending you tape, and then you've got people sending you USBs with contemporary recordings. I mean, last year we got a hard drive of 11,000 but 11,000 field recordings in one go, you know, and you have to process them all and catalogue them all, and that's, you know, 11,000. Fair number.
That's a lot.
Yeah. But all of this has to be done.
I think before I joined the Sound Archive, I was more of a visual person. You know, I loved photography, I loved looking at photographs, loved it, and wasn't that aware of the sound or tuned into the sound. But since working here, you completely switch your brain switches around completely. You know, you go from being very visual and looking at things and to actually not being too bothered about that, or you're not taking it in as much as you would the sound. So it's the sound part of your brain that's like firing off if you're in a new place, whereas the visual side has kind of been dampened a little bit. I completely found that. I mean, I would go to places which I thought were visually stunning, but once I started here, I would revisit them, and then I would kind of focus more on the sound element of it. And again, they can be very sonically stunning. But I think now I certainly do that. So if I go to the, you know, you go to the coast, beautiful coast, but in my head, the bit that's dominating is, how does the sea sound? You know, are there any birds around? Is it? So it's completely switched. So I've kind of been, yes, yeah, it's certainly changed the way I look at things working at the Sound Archive.
It's interesting, there's a, you know, we take for granted that a large part of the history of photography has been a sort of amateur pursuit, and people have, you know, since the 1900s, early 20th century, people have been taking photographs for their family albums and to record family events and things that are very personal to them. Is there an equivalent activity with sound recording?
I think there is. People are recording sounds that are personal to them, but it may not necessarily be people sounds, you know. I know recordists who have recorded in their back garden for 50 years or in the village where they live because they love the sounds of it, you know, and it's personal to them. Or, for example, another recordist that I know, he records at a particular beach on the Isle of Wight because that's where his father's ashes were scattered, so it means something to him. And rather than just take a picture of that beach, he records the sound of the sea coming in and going out. And
in photography, in the last 20 years or so, there's been a massive increase in interest in this legacy of amateur and family photography. And it could be from, you know, just the fact that somebody has taken personal pictures of their own lives, or it could be that they're connected to a bigger global event or something. So it's, you know, it's Nazi soldier family albums type of thing. I'm wondering whether there's going to be an equivalent sound recording thing come online that people will start to, these things will come out and be bought from, you know, appear on eBay, or that there's this sort of legacy of private sound recording is going to come into circulation. What do you think?
I think it could well do. I mean, I know field recorders to go out and they record events that are happening that will be seen as historically significant. You know, I mean, I know people have been to protests, certainly field recordists working in Paris have recorded memorial services, you know, like for the Charlie Hebdo shootings and those kind of things. At the time you may think, oh well, I'm just recording this, but in 50 years time or in 100 years time, or if people are recording rallies or all of these things, they will become increasingly significant, I think, for historical reasons. And again, you get more of a sense of what's happening at the time. You know, you can see a photograph of a rally, but what did it sound like? You know, were people banging drums? Were they blowing whistles? Were things going off? You know, so if you have that sound recording, it gives you more of a sense of the mood, I think, with a sound recording. And so a lot of the recordings that are being made that are linked to, you know, sort of things that are happening today will become increasingly significant, which is why we're kind of branching out what we archive. So it's not just about the natural world anymore. It's for my section, it's going out, and so we're bringing in other material that would not necessarily fit perfectly with the section, but we still see its importance and we think it should be archived. If no one else is archiving it, then we will.